Good morning, everybody. Today is Monday, June 27th, 2016, and this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Monday, everyone. It is a humid 68 degrees and partly cloudy here in upstate New York. We had some big boomers that came through here last night, woke me up at like 3 o'clock in the morning, but now we're just suffering the after effects of humidity. So where do we leave off on Friday? We titled the show, Gates and Google Sucking You Into the Internet of Things. We talked about a lot of crazy stuff the last 5 or 6 weeks. And one of the big things was the Recombatant Agency, as part of the National Institute of Health, approving the very first CRISPRing of humans, being able to genetically modify humans to cure cancer, as part of the University of Pennsylvania's Mad Science Gone Mad department. We discovered that there's been sprinkle funding not only from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, but also from Google. We have Sean Parker, billionaire from Facebook, that is helping fund some of these very first trials. We also discovered that the president of the University of Pennsylvania was appointed to the Ethics Committee of the federal government back in 2009 by Obama, which makes a lot of sense because the ethics are completely out of window. A lot of this man's science has been originating in the Ivy League colleges, specifically Harvard University is one, MIT, where nanotechnology began with good old Eric Drexler, and the Weiss Institute as part of Harvard. Today, what I've had saved for a while, and I think today would be a good day to do it, we are going to listen to an interview by George M. Church. And George Church is kind of like the granddaddy of CRISPR. He did an interview back in March titled The Augmented Human Being with a publication called The Edge. And let's look a little bit of the history of George Church, because I think you will find this extremely interesting. George McDonald Church, born August 28, 1954, is an American geneticist, molecular engineer, and a chemist. And as of 2015, he is the Robert Winthrop Professor of Genetics at Harvard Medical School and Professor of Health Sciences and Technology at Harvard and MIT, as well as a founding member of the Weiss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard. Hey, home of the Robo-Bees. He then trained at the Phillips Academy with Sung-Hoo Kim at Duke University and with Walter Gilbert at Harvard University, and then in a postdoctoral fellowship with Gail R. Martin at the University of California, San Francisco. Then Church began his independent career as an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School in 1986. Ding, ding! Right around the time period that all this mad science got let out of the bag. For his career, he spent 6 months in 1984 at Biogen, an industrial laboratory where Professor Gilbert had relocated a sizable part of his former Harvard group, and this was soon followed after by a Life Sciences Research Foundation at the University of California, San Francisco, with Gail R. Martin, a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the joint discoverer of a technique to extract mouse embryonic stem cells. Church joined Harvard Medical School facility as an assistant professor in 1986, and in his subsequent research, Church has risen to the level of Robert Winthrop Professor of Genetics at Harvard Medical School and to a member of the Harvard MIT Health Sciences and Technology faculty, described as a unique collaboration integrating science, medicine, and engineering to solve problems with human health at the Institute for Medical Engineering and Sciences at MIT. As well, he was a founding member of the Weiss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard University. And in these positions, Church, as of May of 2014, is reported to have co-authored more than 330 publications, 60 patents, and a popular science book. Church also served as director of the Center for Bioenergy Technology at Harvard, funded by a multi-year award by who? Oh, the the U.S. Department of Energy. Remember, we found out that's where the synthetic biology report to Congress came from. And he is part of the Center of Excellence in Genomic Science at Harvard, but likewise funded by a P50 type award from the National Human Genome Research Institute as a part of the National Institute of Health. Church is best known for his professional contributions in the sequencing of genomes and interpreting such data in synthetic biology and genome engineering, and in an emerging area of neuroscience that proposes to brain map activity and establish a functioning connectome. Now, we talked about that many, many times as well, but we also mentioned that on Friday, that they have a brand new tool that is way more accurate than any genome mapping that they have ever had before, and they are able to not only read thoughts, but to be able to take thoughts and turn them into text. And now they're working on taking thoughts and turning them into voice so they can speak what you are thinking. They're able to extract images from your mind as well. This is very horrifying. And this is the same man that is a founding member of the Weiss Institute of Harvard. He is also one of the granddaddies of CRISPR. He is one of the ones that's looking to recreate and clone the woolly mammoth. And he's involved with the Department of Energy, Synthetic Biology, and Human CRISPRing. Among these, Church is known for pioneering the specialized fields of personalized genomics, precision medicine, and synthetic biology. And he has co-founded commercial concerns spanning these areas, from other green and natural product chemistries to infectious agent testing and fuel production. Gotta love how those are all bundled into the same thing. And as of 2015, according to Google Scholar, most of his cited research has been published in peer-reviewed scientific journals. As part of the Brain Initiative, he was part of a team of six who in 2012, the scientific commentary proposed a brain map activity, later named the Brain Initiative, which, of course, has now become a national initiative, is edicted by Obama. They outlined specific experimental techniques that might be used to achieve what they termed a functional connectome, as well as new technologies that will be developed throughout the course of the project. Reading your thoughts, turning them into voice. And he's also working on including wireless connectivity to the brain, minimally invasive methods to detect and manipulate neuronal activity, either utilizing microelectronics or synthetic biology. Yeah, this is the type of guy you want to invite over for a weekend party at Bernie's. He's been involved also in woolly mammoth cloning. In March 2015, Church and his genetic research team at Harvard successfully copied woolly mammoth genes into the genome of an Asian elephant. And using CRISPR DNA editing techniques, he and his group spliced genetic segments from a frozen mammoth specimen, including genes from the ears, subcutaneous fat, and hair attributes, into the DNA and skin cells of a modern elephant. And their work has not been subjected to any peer review, however, so don't worry about it. This is the behind-closed-door shit we talk about all the time. We're going to catch an interview by him. This interview is about 57 minutes or so, so it should take us right up to the end of the show, and I will be back fully live for a full hour tomorrow. So I hope you enjoy it. Take care.
I worry about a lot of things. I encourage people to worry about a lot of things, but worry in the sense of taking action, doing something about it, but being cautious as you do something about it, doing safety engineering. So every field of engineering has a safety component eventually. So you have civil engineering, aerospace, so forth. They have huge amounts of the budget that go to safety components, and I think biology is no exception. Certainly pharmaceuticals have a huge fraction of the budget for bringing a new drug to market is not the research and development that produces the first prototype drug, but it's all the clinical trials, toxicity, efficacy, testing. So I think about this, and some of the technologies we come up with are pretty transformative, disruptive in a good sense. And so the more transformative they are, the more important it is to consider safety up front. Ideally, talk about it before it's on the streets. So a counterexample is the influenza gain-of-function research, where they brought to influenza some pretty scary new capabilities and didn't discuss it with really anybody who could have modulated or blocked or cautioned them in their research until they were ready to publish it, which is kind of a little too late. It should have been, it's the sort of thing that should have been regulated before even the first grant proposal was made, much less the first research or the first paper. So some of the things that we want people to worry about at the, in a enabling way these days going forward are a lot of new applications of a new technology, which is CRISPR. We helped invent that. January 2013 was when it was first published, and but the applications are even more shocking than those papers that showed that you could, in January 2013, the papers basically said that you can do homologous recombination, meaning precise editing, not kind of random editing, but really say if you want a G to switch to an A, you can do that very efficiently in human stem cells. That's what we said. So CRISPR was a phenomenology since 1987, but it didn't turn into a technology until 2012-13. And that and what it is a mechanism by which bacteria protected themselves from invading viruses by making a molecular machine that would recognize those viruses and cut their DNA, hopefully killing or at least disabling the virus. That was then It seemed like that might be adaptable to turning it from a killing machine into an editing machine, but that wasn't that transition didn't occur until wasn't public at least until 2013, and the way it does it is it has it's a molecular machine like many enzymes, catalysts, are a protein component, and this one has a nucleic acid component. A relative of DNA, which is RNA, and the two will then scan along your genome, more or less randomly, jumping around, sometimes revisiting the same site over and over. This is the wrong site, but eventually it finds the right site, and when it does, it rearranges the double-stranded DNA to insert the RNA, and now making a triple strand, and then the protein cuts both strands. Now you've got a broken piece of DNA, which is seems like it's killing still, not editing. But that break allows you to bring in yet another molecule, which is now your donor DNA, which now has the new sequence that you'd like to swap in. It can cause a deletion or an insertion or just a change of sequence with the same number of base pairs, like G's, A's, T's, and C's, just changing the composition, the order. Now that's editing. It's just like you would edit a book or an article. You want to be precise. You don't want to just change G to some random other thing. You want to change it to an A. And that's what that's the technology that we happened to demonstrate first. We moved it from bacteria into human, a huge jump, and in January 2013. And then many other labs, including ours, applied it to many other organisms. Basically, there's no organism on the planet that I know of that somebody's tried that doesn't work in now, which is not true for every editing method. And this editing method, you could say, is just a little more efficient and a lot cheaper, but that makes it sound like it's an increment. But every now and then, if it's a sufficiently large increment, it's transformative. And that's, I think, most people that are familiar with it are classifying it as transformative. And for example, when you look at the applications of it, beyond engineering human stem cells, which we showed first thing, it can now you can engineer, you can do gene therapy with greater precision than ever before. That's the most obvious thing. You can, a little less obvious, is you can engineer agricultural species in such a way that many governments are now classifying it as not a genetically modified organism. This is a big deal. I mean, it shouldn't be a big deal. It should be a minor bureaucratic footnote. But in fact, whether an organism is genetically modified or not, because of people willfully ignoring scientific studies on safety, they draw this sharp line between genetically modified and not, especially for foods. Even the most ardent anti-GM are still pro-GM if it's life and death, like genetically modified insulin, where you grow human insulin and bacteria. But we'll come back to that. So that those two things are the more obvious ones, which is human gene therapy, more precise and efficient than ever, and agricultural. And then becoming less obvious, since fewer groups working on it, very few, is gene drives, which can be used to eliminate any vector-borne disease, malaria, dengue, Lyme disease, as well as invasive species like rodents that are killing off precious endangered species on hundreds of islands worldwide and mainlands. So that's gene drives. And then transplantation, going from pigs to humans, is a million people in need of transplants. It's not limited by just incompatibility between people. It's just there are just not enough people. Even if we were all compatible, there are not enough donors. And so pigs offered that possibility, but there were two problems. One is with the immune incompatibility, and the other is they had endogenous viruses. And so we've used CRISPR to solve both of those problems. And then there's ecosystem manipulation. In addition to gene drives, you can address the isolation of species elements, the territories shrinking, getting divided by roads and other human artifacts, farms and so forth, so that now they become inbred. And when they become inbred, they become less robust, less fertile, and that's because and that can be found by another revolution that we've been involved in, which is next-generation sequencing or reading the genome. And you can now insert, using CRISPR, the proper, more fertile, and more robust version of the genes, or generate greater diversity. Now, some of that diversity you can bring in not only from adjacent populations that are separated by man-made structures, but also diversity from their separated time. So you can bring in DNA from the ancient, extinct versions of these animals, near relatives, because this amazing next-generation sequencing is so inexpensive and powerful that we can reach back up to 700,000 years into the past and get accurate sequences of long extinct species, but with potentially very valuable lessons for modern ecosystems. Right, so yeah, new technologies do change our perception of ourselves. It used to be new discoveries, it's integrating. If you have a new technology like a telescope, it can cause a discovery about where our planet sits in the universe, whether it's at the center or not. But you can have a theory. And more frequently in the present, we have new technologies. And sometimes people ask me, you know, why is everybody so worked up about applying CRISPR to the germline of humans? They're not worked up particularly about applying it to the germline of animals. And we just got approval for genetically modified salmon. and plants have been genetically modified for many years now, even though some people will eat it and some people won't. The fact is it's a multi-billion dollar business. So why are humans special? Well, you could say, well, you know, we have a very special system, the Food and Drug Administration, for in multiple countries that regulate, that make sure that every new medical technology, whether it's a medical device or a pharmaceutical, has to be safe and effective. So it does you no good to have a drug that's safe but does nothing, and nor having one that's very effective but kills people. So we have that in place. So again, what is it that makes germline manipulation of humans special? And I think it's what you were just getting at, our perception of ourselves is, if we feel that we can change any aspect of ourselves, where do you begin and where do you stop, and who sets those rules? When you're in a more primitive phase of the technology, you don't have to ask that question because it seems so far off, and we can only make minor changes. You know, we can, you know, little nip and tuck, cure, a few vaccines. It doesn't fundamentally change human nature. But if you ever did get a tool where you could fundamentally change human nature to anything you wanted, any hybrid with any animal properties that you like, hybridization with your inorganic machines that's more intimate than it is now, changes our view of ourselves. And I guess that's why people consider that they not only want more caution than ever before, which I would concur, they want maybe so much caution that it can never happen. And there are many technologies that get banned at one point or another. It's not unusual. I mean, railroads were banned because trains are colliding with one another, sometimes in the middle of towns. There was a hue and cry about in vitro fertilization. It was pejoratively labeled test tube babies, you know, some kind of scare quotes around test tube babies, as if that was intrinsically yucky and unacceptable. But then the instant in 78, when Elizabeth Brown was born as a beautiful, healthy baby, the first real attempt brought to term, and suddenly it looked like it was 100% successful. And within a few years, there were millions of, there are now, I think, been over 5 million test tube babies. And then for a while, it was kind of quiet between 78 and now. It came up with recombinant DNA that maybe recombinant DNA plus test tube babies would be a big thing, but it still seemed very far off, like could be centuries off. And what happens sometimes is there are delays in technology, you know, like where's my, you know, jetpack or my flying car, and other times it comes faster than we think. So next generation sequencing should have taken, if you drew, you know, lines of, you know, trend lines, if it went like the way computers go, which is pretty fast, it should have taken a little less than a century to arrive, and instead it took a little less than a decade. Same thing with CRISPR as a way of doing genome engineering. It came out of nowhere. I mean, there was no CRISPR technology in beginning in 2013, and 3 years later, it's everywhere. It's all over the place, and it's quite plausible that we can do genome engineering. So the reason that some of these technologies arrive so far ahead of expectations is a mixture of, you know, obsessive pursuit by engineers and serendipity. And these are, and I think with next generation sequencing, a little of each, my group has been involved in almost every different way of doing next-gen sequencing, ranging from nanopore sequencing to fluorescent sequencing to electronic sequencing like IonTorrent. And similarly, we've been involved in every way of doing genome engineering, starting with recombinant DNA, with endogenous homologous recombination, so-called meganucleases, which one of my mentors as a graduate student, Bernard Dujon, discovered. It was only the first of the ways of cutting DNA, that CRISPR is now the most recent. It was also the first gene drive that he discovered in the early 1980s. Yeah, so Bernard Dujon was one of my co-mentors during my PhD, and he discovered the first meganucleus, the first really very specific cleavage where it would cleave once in a genome, and then after that, zinc fingers. We were involved in the zinc fingers with Aaron Klug, started a little company called Gendak, which was later became part of Sangamo, and then proteins were even easier to program than meganucleases or zinc fingers. We were involved in that, including one of my talented postdocs named Feng Zhang. He and I worked together on talons, and then he started up his own lab at MIT, and then we both started working on this new phenomenon called CRISPR. It had been in the literature since the 1987, but it was only starting to dawn on groups, mainly biochemists like Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier, how you would go about harnessing this as a technology. There were a number of people before Jennifer, Emmanuel, Feng, and my own labs that had established that it was important in resisting viruses and bacteria, but turning it into a technology of gene editing, I think, was non-obvious, and in fact had a good chance of failure. For example, we had been trying to adapt another genome editing, genome engineering strategy, which we called MAGE, so other people called recombineering, but that really still, after decades of work, only works in E. coli, or only works well in E. coli, and we have not been able to transfer it to other organisms. CRISPR, on the other hand, serendipitously works in every organism without major modifications, just tweaking how the component molecules are produced. Anyway, so Feng Zhang and one of my graduate students, Le Kong, published a paper. Le was the first author in January 2013, side by side with the one that I did with first authors Prashant Malle, who's now at UCSD, and Luhan Yang, who's one of the key players in the xenotransplantation work of applying CRISPR to getting organs from pigs. Everybody read these papers and said it looked pretty easy. We deposited the tools, the molecular tools to do this, in a nonprofit called AdGene, and that just caused it to spread even faster, where people realized that for $50 they could get in the game, and it was really, of all the technologies that helped develop, this was probably the easiest one for people to adopt. Next-gen sequencing, it had a big million-dollar machine, even in the very early days, to practice it. This, you just needed whatever you already had, plus this little plasmids you get from this nonprofit AdGene. And then it just spread, and the rest is sort of history. Yeah, so getting back to why people should worry about it, I think there's these very powerful applications, which is like somatic gene therapy in adults, which people should be worried about. So gene therapy in adults, there's now 2,000 gene therapies where you'll take a little piece of engineered DNA, put it inside of a viral coat, so all the viral genes are gone, and you put in, say, a human gene. Or you can have non-viral delivery, but the important thing is you're delivering it either inside of a human, or you're taking cells out of the human and putting the DNA in and then putting them back in. But you can do very powerful things like curing inherited diseases, curing infectious diseases. For example, you can edit out the receptor for the HIV virus and cure AIDS patients. And in a way that's not dependent on vaccines and, you know, multi-drug resistance, which has plagued the HIV/AIDS story from the very beginning. So it's you're basically making a human being, which is now altered, augmented in a certain sense, so that unlike most humans, they are resistant to this major plague of mankind, which is HIV/AIDS. So there are now people walking around who are genetically modified. There are some that are resistant to AIDS because they've had their T cells or their, more generally, their blood cells modified. There are people that there are children that have been cured of blindness by gene therapy. None of this is CRISPR, but it's in the same vein. CRISPR is overtaking it very quickly, and it's in a sense drafting behind all the really beautiful work that's been done with delivery of DNA, delivery of genetic components to patients. But there are 2,000 gene therapies of various sorts in clinical trials in phase 1, 2, and 3. Typically, phase 1 is about toxicity, phase 2 is about efficacy, and phase 3 is when you really say, is it ready for market? One has been approved. It's been approved in Europe by the EMA, not in America yet. It's for it's called Glybera. It's for a pancreatitis, a lipid disorder. It is the most expensive drug in history. It's over $1 million per dose. In principle, it could be one dose per lifetime. So it's comparable to orphan drugs, which are rare disease treatments. But it's and we can hope that we can bring down the cost either by going for larger markets. So some of the diseases that are aimed at are not rare diseases, but they're more common ones. These infectious diseases. No, typically, so the Orphan Drug Act is a way of encouraging the industry to go after these very rare diseases by permitting them to charge the correct amount to compensate for the drug development costs and profit and get reimbursed for it. So so now they're handfuls of orphan drugs, and in fact, I think at this point, even though these are very, very rare, I mean, some of these diseases are 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000. They're very rare. They nevertheless are gaining profitability, which is on the order of 30% of the entire pharmaceutical industry. So now, nobody is sure whether this is sustainable. If we get to the point where we have custom drugs, basically every person has their own drug, and each of those drugs costs $500 million to produce, then we're broke. But if we get better at it, and in fact, if we have a class of drugs that works really well, where you can use smaller cohorts and prove it. I mean, by definition, rare drugs, you're using small cohorts. Sometimes they're so small, you never even make it to phase 3. For example, some of these hereditary blindnesses, you gather up everybody in the world that you can find that is willing to participate, and you cure them all, or most of them, and now you can't move on to phase. In the toxicity trial, you actually proved efficacy and you cured them. And there's really nobody left in the world to cure. That's a pretty high quality first world problem to have that happen. So anyway, that's all in adults and children. Sometimes you have to do it in children because the brain is wired up at an early age, and so if you cure blindness late in life, you can make it so the patient can see, the photons can see that there's something going on that they didn't see before, but they can't process it. They can't say, oh, that's a face, or that's a person. It's just kind of these blurry or even sharp but uninterpretable images. So if you do it early enough, then they can actually develop close to fully functional vision. So you can imagine some developmental diseases that affect, especially those that affect the brain, you might have to do it as a fetus. So there's already fetal surgery that's done to catch things, but if you have to tinker with the molecules, you might want to do it as a fetus, or you might want to do it even earlier, and then you get into this whole business of whether you can do the germline or not. And society doesn't know where to draw the line. Is the line drawn germline, or is it drawn at the level of medical significance? In other words, if it's very medically significant, it doesn't matter whether it's in an adult or a child or a fetus or an embryo or a sperm or an egg. If the positive impact is high enough and there's no alternative, but sometimes people like to draw lines with a buzzword rather than with a sharp medical. I mean, an example is golden rice, where the line, I would think, should be drawn between medical versus non-medical foods. So most GM foods, I have to agree with the GM critics, don't really get the average person anything that they can recognize. You go to the supermarket and there's not that big a difference between the GM foods and the not GM foods in terms of price or quality or anything like that. So why not object to them? You know, I mean, anything that you can label, you can start an ad campaign that's effective. You can say, you know, potato chips without cholesterol. They never did have cholesterol, but now the labeling sells a few more bags of them. So that makes sense. But then golden rice was a tough call strategically for Greenpeace, let's say, and some of their associates. They could have classified that as medical, like the way that you would classify GM insulin. It's very powerful, and a million lives are at stake every year due to vitamin A deficiency. And golden rice is basically ready for use in 2002. So it's been 13 years that it's been ready. And every year that you delay it, that's another million people dead. That's mass murder on a high scale. And in fact, as I understand it, that there's an effort to bring them to trial at The Hague for crimes against humanity. Maybe that's justified, maybe it isn't. But you know, the fact is, we have a pretty good way of addressing this vitamin A deficiency, and nothing else has worked during those intervening 13 years. It's hard to get them pills because that's very expensive. These are people where they can barely afford rice as their sole source of calories. How are they going to afford medicine? Greenpeace is very well funded. They have many, many times more funding than the groups that are developing the golden rice, and they can lobby the governments to say it's not safe, and they can demand higher and higher levels of safety testing. And then when the safety testing starts to look really good, they can go in and trash the plots of land that's growing the golden rice through vandalism, as happened in the Philippines recently, and then say, well, where's the safety data? Well, it was destroyed by the vandals. So there are many ways that you can block development or approval of something that's quite clearly safe. So the same thing can happen with the human germline. You could just treat it the same as other medical technologies, artificial limbs, new pharmaceuticals, and so forth. They have to be shown to be safe and effective. Or you could draw a line saying, if it has the word germline modification in it, then no matter how safe it is, we're going to take a less safe method or no, nothing, rather than have this scare word involved. And I think, I think that once it's proven to be safe and effective, it will be like in vitro fertilization. It will be very difficult to deprive people of a technology that's going to help their children. Now, in all fairness, it has to be, there has to be no alternative. Or typically in medicine, it's not relative to nothing. It's relative to various other technologies. And in the case of genome editing or gene therapy more broadly, the challenges, the alternatives are things like genetic counseling. So the parallel revolution of next generation sequencing provides an alternative for next generation genome editing in this case, because as the price has plummeted from $3 billion to now less than $1,000, complete with interpretation and genetic counseling, you can stop many of these diseases way before you need $1 million gene therapy. So you can prioritize who you're going to date. You know, if you have a particular very hazardous or deleterious carrier status, let's say you have Tay-Sachs carrier status, that's a very it's a disease that when you have two copies, from one from each parent, the child is very disabled and usually dies a painful death shortly after birth. It's something that most families try to avoid. But there are many, many people who don't know they're at risk until they get the first child. And so the solution is for everybody to know their genome and to not use it as a way of wasting money on hypochondria, but of seeing if there's something very well characterized in medicine, something that's highly predictive and actionable by deciding who you're going to date and then marry. Or it can be done later with slightly more medical and psychosocial inconvenience at the stage of prenatal testing, including a revolution that's coming in part because of next-generation sequencing called non-invasive prenatal testing, where you can test the fetus's genes by getting a little bit of blood from the mother. So the cost of gene therapy, of genetic counseling, is about $1,000, which can save you $1 million later for either orphan drugs or gene therapy. Now, all these prices will drop, but the point is that at current costs, and not only that, there's not a developed gene therapy that's been approved, or an orphan drug, and the anxiety of hunting down and figuring out what the genetic problem is after you've already got symptoms in a child, like developmental delay, is not worth it, even if the prices were identical. So I think that you need to temper the enthusiasm and concern for these new technologies with the alternative technologies, for example, genetic counseling. Oh, I forgot to mention aging reversal. This is a big project both in my lab and in one of our startup companies. This is not about wellness or drugs that affect diseases of aging, which are effects rather than causes, trying to get at the causes of aging and reverse them. And there's a fair number of precedents for this in animals, but the idea is to get it transferred into humans. Reversal of aging, I mean, some examples of this are if you take blood from a young mouse and exchange it with an old mouse, the small molecules, macromolecules, and cells in the blood result in a variety of biomarkers of aging being reversed. So you can affect the vasculature, the blood vessels, the nerves, the skeletal and cardiac muscles, and there are measures of these that indicate that it's not just prolonging a very aged state or going for longevity. You're actually reversing it. And this is a much better target in any case than prolonging longevity, because A, it takes years to decades to even prove that you've extended longevity, and also if you've just if you've done it on somebody that's quite old, then the economic consequences are dire. I mean, that's the part of your life where you spend huge amounts on medicine and don't improve the quality of life tremendously. So if you can reverse it to an age where you essentially don't use any medicine, this is much more this will be much more cost effective. You know, it's the whole point. The reason that an academic would help start so many companies is it is a way of accelerating the pace at which technology is transferred from an idea to an experiment that might get published in a paper that has no impact on society other than scientists that read it, from a paper to a company, from a company to the market. So, for example, the next generation of sequencing technology, I think quite a few of them now, are starting to have impact in things like non-invasive prenatal testing. Some have said that this is the fastest growing medical diagnostic in history. It's gone from basically non-existent 3 or 4 years ago to now millions of women that have been tested for mainly for trisomies, so things that can cause fetal wastage or severe medical problems later in life. I mean, you know, one of the issues with the transition from academic work to corporate work that's needed to get it into have an impact on society are questions about scale and secrecy. Now, some of the practices in academia and small startups and even large companies are aligned. So some of them are motivated to publish in the same journals, sometimes side by side, because a good, high quality, peer reviewed article is a magnet for attracting some of the best scientists to come join you. If you do everything in total secrecy, the very best scientists, I mean, you can always hire somebody, but the very best scientists don't know you exist. They don't really care deeply. But publishing can happen in similar ways in companies and academia. Another aspect of secrecy is without patents, there would be a lot more secrecy than there is. But patent system is a way of tantalizing and encouraging companies to put their ideas and their inventions in the public domain. They give them a limited monopoly for 20-some years, but only if they describe in enough detail that it is considered enabling. Enabling technologies, when they're patented, everybody can then build on top of them. Some people claim that there still will be trade secrets, but not nearly as much, because if you keep it secret and somebody else patents it, then they win, because your secrets are no longer valuable to you because they can sue you for infringing their patent. Even if you did it first, now, worldwide, it's first to file, not first to invent. The fact that you've been keeping a secret all this time does you no good anymore in the United States, and that's a fairly recent development. So you really have to file it, and that was kind of the whole point. Some people say that patents, you know, are evil somehow, but the alternative is worse, which is trade secrets, which is what would be rampant otherwise. And also, the patents don't stop people from inventing. To some extent, they help us to invent, because we can look at the patent, oh, that's how they did it. And you can build on top of it, stand on the shoulders of giants. The only thing it prevents you from doing is doing the same thing that somebody else did and then making money without giving them a cut. That's what's banned. And so some people say, well, why would I want to invent on top of somebody else's technology? Because I'm just going to have to give it all to them. Well, sometimes you don't have to give it all to them. You can cross-license. You can make a deal where they give you something, you give them something, or where you're both enabled. It's a case-by-case, and it depends on how much value you add. If you add enough value, you could get more than the original patent, which might have been very preliminary and limited. So Revive and Restore is a spin-off of the Long Now Foundation. Ryan Phelan and Stuart Brand have been championing the merging of some of the most cutting-edge molecular methods like CRISPR and next-generation sequencing with very significant needs in the ecological, environmental conservation movements. We have islands that have many of the world's most diverse and beautiful species, birds, reptiles, amphibia, and so forth, and they're endangered by invasive species, new diseases, slight changes in just even a few degrees change in temperature can shift the ecosystems faster than the species can adapt. We could just say, well, let nature take its course, even though humans are influencing it, or we can use these powerful molecular methods to track, diagnose it, and then to take action with gene drives or with preparing vaccines, gene drives being a kind of vaccination that spreads itself making synthetic viruses so we can accelerate the process using CRISPR vaccines to fight them, as we're doing for the herpes virus in elephants. So Revive and Restore is largely about conserving important ecosystems, not just important in some abstract sense, but sometimes in a very practical human self-centered way. So, for example, in the tundra of Canada, Siberia, Russia, and Alaska, the permafrost is supposedly permanent, is melting, and with it is being, could be released as much as 2 times the carbon of all the forests all over the world, as if they all burnt and released their carbon dioxide and methane into the air, causing global warming. And some of the environmental studies, for example, from the Zimov group, have shown that if you can restore some of the keystone species that were there not too long ago, that have very recently left or gone extinct, you can lower the temperature by 15 to 20 degrees, which could greatly delay or maybe even reverse the process of permafrost thawing. So some of the questions that come up with Revive and Restore of using cutting-edge molecular technologies for ecosystem conservation, preservation, some of the same questions come up with using these molecular technologies in medicine, which is who gets to choose, who decides, are people not being heard or not being invited to sit to talk. I think in all these cases, both medical and environmental, there is maybe more than ever before an effort to engage all sorts of citizens. Regular folks that know science, at least before they start the conversation. Patient advocates, environmental advocates, scientists, ethicists, lawyers, politicians, and so forth. Many of these meetings are presented in video conference, on the web, webcast, real time, and Twitter questions are encouraged. It doesn't mean it's perfect, but at least it's very different from, say, the Manhattan Project, where the public was not invited to weigh in on whether we should, for example, take a chance that atmospheric testing would ignite the atmosphere. That was one of the things the physicists tried to calculate on their own without anybody meddling. If it had ignited the atmosphere, that would not have been highly protective to our nation or the world. I think here, the idea is to get as many people thinking about the unintended consequences as possible and to proceed cautiously. Now, the question of who decides ultimately with these kind of transparent and open projects where it's not being done in secret, like the Manhattan Project, is society decides. Is we vote with our wallets, we vote, you know, with the free enterprise system, with our politics, the power of the pen, and it may not be and in some cases it's we may change our mind later, and so there's an emphasis on things that are reversible if that's those get higher priority. But eventually we do irreversible things. Certainly it'd be very hard at this point to surgically remove automobiles from our lives. Even though they kill a million people per year, we couldn't just delete them. It would be very hard to go back to previous agricultural methods, because the early pre-agricultural society could not possibly sustain 7 billion. In fact, probably even just a couple of generations back in crops could not sustain 7 billion people. So who decides whether a particular species come back? It could be, does it help human beings? It's a very species chauvinistic way of looking at it, but it, hopefully it will involve many countries making this decision, maybe at the United Nations level. Certainly with gene drives, where you're unlike vaccines, where you have medical professionals going door to door, essentially village to village, gene drives and mosquitoes do it themselves, and you could spread throughout sub-Saharan Africa. They don't respect borders or wars or any other things that would hold back medical professionals. So you probably want to get the buy-in of all the nations, not just the ones that are most desperately in need of the gene drives to eliminate malaria. Well, it's a extraordinarily exciting time for scientists, in particular those involved in reading and writing genomes, but it should be an exciting time for everybody, and also a scary time for scientists and everybody, where an increasing number of decisions of politicians, CEOs, and regular citizens depend on some technical nuance and expertise.